The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Andrew Kleiman, author of Reclaiming Marx's Capital and the Failure of Capitalist Production, returns this week to discuss Brexit and the rise of the far right. What might be unique about this discussion is that we start out by agreeing that, one way or another, the Brexit vote needs to be understood in the context of the economic crisis of 2007 and the Eurozone crisis that followed. You wouldn't think that this would be a unique perspective, as concerns about the Eurozone crisis have strengthened UKIP and other anti-EU voices, and it has been in the context of the European debt crisis that Cameron was finally forced to capitulate to calls for a Brexit referendum. And yet, as the crisis continued, the arguments about what to do, and even about what the problem really was, shifted. Last year, for instance, during the crisis in Greece, Nigel Farage spoke against the EU and advocated for a Greek exit at the European Parliament. Farage argued that the differences between Greece and Germany were fundamentally cultural, that the plan to forge a European identity and a European currency had both failed, and that the EU itself was overall a failure. Strangely, and perhaps not at all obviously, this focus on the question of whether or not the EU could still function was a way to turn away from the problem of the crisis itself. It's the 30th of June, 2016, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. The big announcement this week is that Zero Books is going to bring a membership site. It's in development. Our new line of interview books, Advancing Conversations, will be made available as audiobooks in the months ahead, and we will be offering workshops on critical theory, politics, and economics through the site, as well as a members-only podcast. I should also say that if you're a fan of Zero Books, you ought to consider signing up for our monthly newsletter to find out about upcoming titles like Daniel Coffeen's Reading the Way of Things, Jeff Bercy's Centering the Margins, and Elliot Funtershell's Zen City. And if you're a regular listener to the podcast, I'd encourage you to follow me on Facebook, follow me, Douglas Lane, on Facebook, or to follow Zero Books, or to leave a review of the show on iTunes. You can find links to our newsletter, to our Facebook groups, and to our Twitter handle, all in the show notes. The music in this episode includes an instrumental version of Led Zeppelin's Stairway to Heaven, as performed by the Vitamin String Quartet, as well as sound clips from Nigel Farage and Donald Trump. You'll also hear a short excerpt from Ilya Kazan's A Face in the Crowd, and the music you're listening to right now is the Django Rock Band covering Pink Floyd's In the Flesh. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Andrew Kleiman and I discuss Brexit and the danger of a left-right convergence. So what I'm trying to figure out is how much of the problems around the EU, the unpopularity of the EU, have to do with the Eurozone crisis and the economic crisis, and how much of it is political or cultural or something else. Because, you know, as you just said, the arguments about Brexit weren't really about banking policy. I have this instinct, but I don't have any of the data. I don't really know. But I have this instinct that this is really about the ongoing repercussions of the 2007 economic crisis and the way that has never really been fully resolved. Is that a fair estimation?
Well, I think so, yeah. And I think it's a very astute And unusual observation. I mean, when did we learn? Friday morning that Brexit had won. So it's now 5.5 days later. I've been reading and reading and reading. And I've come across exactly one article in a very obscure publication that drew that link to the economic crisis. In other words, people say, oh, you know, people have been dispossessed and they're worried about jobs and inequality and the elites and the elites and the elites. You hear a lot of that. And they make it sound like, you know, there's just been this trend going on for decades. The problem is, how come this has all happened now? You know, why does all of a sudden, in a surprising way, Brexit, you know, win a vote now? And is it a coincidence that, you know, that Donald Trump is the presumptive Republican nominee for president right now? And there's a rise of xenophobic, nativist, you know, hard right nationalist parties, you know, National Front and so forth in France. Why is that all happening now? And it has to do with, as you said, the Great Recession and the slow recovery and incomplete recovery, especially in Europe, from the recession. Okay, so there, but also in the United States, this is a lot of what we're seeing, I think, in the United States too. It's not like, you know, decades of inequality, you know, some abstraction that is driving a lot of these factors, or a lot of these, you know, the Brexit vote, the rise of Trumpism, and so forth. Okay, a lot of it has to do specifically with the new situation since about 2008. And it's interesting why that doesn't get commented on much. But it has to do with the fact that neither the right nor the left want to deal with that issue.
Well, that's interesting. My problem with it is that if you do think it's the recession or the economic crisis of 2007 that's somehow causing this in some way, the question for me is, why didn't it happen in 2012? Why didn't we have a far-right reaction? Why did Obama get a second term? Why did it take 8 years for this reaction to develop, or 9 years?
Well, I think it's been growing. I think you've seen a lot of political instability, really, since about 2010. You know, Obama's reelection is, I think, a bit of a surprise. But, you know, this is, I think, what we should expect is governments to come in, for them not to be able to resolve the issue, for new elections, you know, for the ins to be voted out, and new people to come in. I think that's what we've seen, a lot of that, and I expect to, you know, continue to see that. I can't tell you why specifically did Obama win an election versus Romney. It's hard to know. I mean, he didn't do as well in 2012 as he did in 2008. You know, right on the heels of the economic crisis.
Also, Romney didn't represent the same factions of the U.S. right as Trump does.
Oh, not at all. You know, and in fact, Romney, I think, is not going to vote for Trump. You know, and Romney is, of course, you know, famous for, what is it, 47-49% of people don't pay taxes. And, you know, he's a financial guy. So, you know, yeah. But still, right, why were the ins not voted out in the U.S. in 2012? You know, there are probably a zillion reasons. But we have been seeing this uptick in the parties in power going out of power and vice versa. By the way, I don't want to reduce the British situation, the Brexit, to the economic crisis. You know, there are obviously other factors, and immigration is one of them. But the salience of the immigration issue, you know, has to do a lot with jobs and with social spending on immigrants, and all of that is tied to worsening, you know, or worse economic conditions since the crisis.
There's been a general financial crisis, a general economic crisis, and then it's been kind of moved around as to, and certain countries, smaller countries, are being asked to shoulder most of the burden and the pain, while the bigger countries are trying to protect themselves and competing to protect themselves. Not necessarily protect their own populations or the working class, but generally just protect their economy. I look at the Brexit and I think, oh, what this means is that the UK, a certain amount of the Tory elite, thinks that it's not in the UK's interest to play nice with the other big European countries anymore. And that whether or not that's the general opinion amongst, obviously that's not the general opinion amongst elites in Britain, and that something else is going on as to why the Brexit vote went the way it went. But that's got to be part of the calculation here. It's like,
well, first, I don't know if it's big countries versus little countries.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yes, Greece is small, but there's other small countries, you know, in terms of population, that are not like that. I mean, if it's speaking about Greece, it's you know, a country that needed a bailout, mm-hmm. and they got a bailout under onerous terms. I mean, the terms are just onerous because they can't fulfill them, you know.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, the question is, whose thinking are you talking about? The Tories, the Conservative Party, the voters? I'm not quite clear about that.
I guess I was thinking that maybe the Tory politicians, the more conservative Tory politicians, and British bankers, or
the financial people. I have no reason. I don't have any knowledge. I don't have any reason to believe that they wanted exit.
Right.
I don't think that the bulk of the Conservative Party wanted exit either.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the prime minister resigned basically right after the vote.
Right.
You know, the UKIP, the United Kingdom Independence Party, that was a breakaway of you know, that kind of faction from the Tories. They wanted it. But I think that from the Conservatives to your Liberal Democrats to the Labour Party, they had a lot of reservations here and there. But I don't think they wanted to leave the European Union.
Obviously, there was a minority within the Tory party, and there was UKIP, and there were a lot of just everyday people who wanted enough to get the vote through that wanted to leave. But I'm just wondering, is there an economic logic to it? Is this in any way a move that makes sense in terms of protecting the interests from a capitalist point of view?
Is it in the interest of British capitalism to get out of the EU? I can't see it.
Yeah, okay.
I can't see it at all. First of all, because of the financial hit that you take with all the turmoil. Right. You could say, well, maybe 10 years down the road, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, God knows what will be 10 years down the road. But secondly, you know, London is a big financial center, mm-hmm. big financial capital. And if there's not easy flow of finance between London and the rest of Europe, I mean, that's just not going to be continuing to the same degree, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So no, I don't think that from the standpoint of British capital, this is at all good.
Okay, so if it is a result of the Eurozone crisis, at least partially, How should we think about it being caused by that if it isn't a reaction to try to protect capital's interest in the country? I'm not sure if my question is making sense, but...
How should we think about what exactly?
How should we think of it as having been caused by the economic crisis, since it's a political decision?
Okay, right. There's two crises that we're talking about here.
Right.
One is the Great Recession, okay? The other is the Eurozone crisis, which I take to mean the crisis of indebted countries that were bailed out, such as Greece.
Mm-hmm.
Those are slightly distinct. Obviously, the second one is a consequence of the first one.
Right.
But they're somewhat distinct. But I think it's pretty clear that if not the main factor, then the deciding factor that tipped the vote toward Brexit in the referendum last week is the immigration issue. And that is a matter of people being forced into a situation in which, they were forced into a situation in which the only way that they could vote for something or against something, but vote in a way that protected their economic interests was to say, screw these immigrants. I mean, there's racism as well, but it was basically, screw these immigrants. I want to protect, my job or whatever. I don't like this social spending that goes to them. I want to protect my pension and so forth. You're going to get much more sentiment like that when times are tough.
Right.
Okay. And times have been tough and nothing has come along, to resolve the crisis. And of course, Britain has basically austerity policies, quite unlike what we've had in the U.S. People aren't given much of a choice of anything. So what they did is, here was finally a choice. And, to some extent, it was a screw you kind of vote. But to a large degree, it was having to do with the immigration. But see, the idea to protect yourself against the foreigners, that is a consequence of economic crisis. And to a large extent, it's what happened in the 1930s as a result of the Great Depression. You had a big wave of protectionism, trade protection, countries imposing barriers to foreign imports and other similar kinds of protection. So it was called rightly beggar thy neighbor. You're going to protect yourself. You're going to get rich by screwing over your neighbor as if it's a zero sum game. The only way you can win is if they lose. And as long as economic conditions don't improve, there's a certain logic to that.
Okay. But that's that beggar thy neighbor approach. That's coming from the working class rather than from the capitalist class. The capitalist class isn't attempting to protect their interest against the interest of other capitalists in other countries, but it's more that working people are trying to protect their jobs and benefits from foreign workers.
Well, I think the immigration vote had a large degree of that kind of protectionist instinct. I don't even like to call it protectionism because we usually think about that as an issue of trade barriers. But it was protecting jobs and keeping state spending to people who are, keep it for the people who are in the country, not for immigrants and so forth. No, I mean, I think that big British capital gains from being in the EU.
Right.
I just don't think that there's really an issue there. And I don't think that in terms of trade or finance, I don't know. I'm not really an expert, and I don't want to go out on a limb here.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, I just think from the standpoint of British capital, being in the EU is what they want. You know, there's a logic to that.
One of my concerns as I see this happening is that I worry about differences between countries developing in ways that might be, you know, militaristic or political. I mean, I see the threat of the 30s rising up again, too. And when Europe isn't unified during an economic crisis, that can be very bad news, right? So I guess what I was kind of trying to get at, and you're sort of in a roundabout way have reassured me that I shouldn't be as frightened as I am. So I just want to make sure that capital isn't like driving us into a world war again here. I mean, is that a paranoid fear?
No, it's not a paranoid fear. Yeah, I think there's every reason to be really concerned about this political moment, because all the previous discussion we've had is what is good for, you know, British capitalists and so forth. Right. That's not necessarily the way things go, right?
Right.
You know, it's not the way things went down here. So circumstances can develop that get out of control. You know, I think what we have to be very concerned about are, you know, things like the National Front in France, the Finns in Finland, you know, the Austrian far right, Donald Trump, all of these folks, they're on the ascendancy. Marine Le Pen was like ecstatic. She said Britain's declared its freedom, and you know, she's the head of the National Front in France. You know, these people sensed their moment. Trump was on his golf course in Scotland, and oh yeah, this is great. You know, they've taken their country back, and he said, quote, "You're going to have many other cases where people want to take their borders back." Right. What's he doing? He's putting up a wall. He's going to put up a wall. He's going to, you know, ban all Muslims except those from Scotland from coming into the States. I mean, at least he's saying he's going to do that, you know. So this is incredibly worrisome. Will there be an international shooting war between big powers? I mean, it's not on the horizon now. But could it happen? Oh, yeah. I mean, basically, the two largest parties in the United Kingdom are in total disarray right now. Both of them, total disarray. And, you know, Scotland is looking to leave. It's quite likely that Scotland will leave, and that means that's the end of the United Kingdom. And once that happens, you know, what happens with Northern Ireland? I mean, I don't know. So you might be left with England and Wales in a matter of a few years. You know, the United Kingdom will be no longer. About 5 in 8 Scottish voters voted to remain in the EU.
Right.
They wanted to be part of Europe. And then they're being told, okay, well, if you want to be part of the United Kingdom, which they weren't that crazy about, and, you know, in general, then you can't be part of the European Union. So they're going to say, you know, we want to be in Europe, not in the United Kingdom, if that's the choice that we're given.
Because they got up at 2 o'clock in the morning and they wrote this song, and it turned into a very, very big hit. It's a thing called Sleepwalk. Ladies and gentlemen, Santo and Johnny.
Hi, my name is Paul Sargent. Welcome once again to AP European History. In today's episode, we're going to take a look at the rise of totalitarian dictatorships. The big picture here is that the Great Depression created a situation where people looked for simple answers.
So Mexico is sending lots of people, and by the way, they're coming from all over the world, including the Middle East. Why not? Come in. Come on in. We're stupid. We'll take care of you. We'll pay. You get sick, we'll take care of your hospitalization. What kind of a plan do you want?
Oh, Don, you're a little controversial. You're talking about illegal immigration. I said it's illegal.
That there are, for immigrants on the whole,
come on, try getting it out. Try getting it out.
I'll get it out.
I mean, I don't know if you're going to put this on television, but you don't even know what you're talking about. Try getting it out. Go ahead.
You were almost gratuitously rude to the parliamentarians, and you enjoyed it.
Now, look, they were abusing me from the moment I started. Twice the President of the Parliament had to cease proceedings and say, please listen to Mr. Farage. Then when I said to them, can we be grown up about this? Can we talk about trade deals? And then they all laughed and giggled. That was what I said to them. But of course, the trouble with you people is none of you have ever had a proper job, which wasn't wrong. They called me all the names under the sun. I just teased them about the fact they're a bunch, basically, of bureaucrats who've never had a proper job. Look, forget that.
You don't like them.
They don't like me. It's mutual.
Why is it that this referendum isn't going to go the way of the Greek referendum, or another one that comes to mind to me, for me, and this is maybe not very much like it, but is the congressional vote against the bailout in 2008. Both the Congress voted against the bailout, but that was overturned by the Senate, really. The Greek people voted not to take the terms that the EU was giving for bailouts, but that was overturned just by Syriza. Why is it that we expect that the Brexit vote will be honored? I mean, is there a chance that they'll just end up not leaving the EU?
There's a chance that they're not going to leave the EU. I don't think it's likely. What I do think is likely, if events don't really get out of hand for, you know, Labour, the Conservatives, the Liberal Democrats, you know, some combination of them is, you know, going to try to form a, you know, a kind of a government. If things don't get out of hand, what is probably the most likely is that they will honor the Brexit on paper, but not in spirit. There is already, I believe Norway, for instance, is not in the EU, but is in the EEA, okay? So it's another institution, and so they're not officially part of the EU, but they are subject to something pretty much the same as a condition of favored terms of trade and so forth. So I expect that that's what will probably be cobbled together. You know, the idea that the UK is going to save a hell of a lot of money, you know, and won't be subject to all these regulations. You know, those were the promises the Leave people, the Brexit people made. That will probably not happen. If it does happen, then, you know, we've got a much bigger economic problem for Britain. I mean, really cutting itself off from the EU like that. So I think that's the most likely thing if things don't get out of hand is, you know, they will no longer be part of the European Union officially, but it won't matter that much.
It'll be a backdoor to it, basically.
Yeah, the same kinds of things will be going on. There are conditions, for instance, that Norway adheres to, even though it's not in the EU, that are not dissimilar from the conditions that, like, Britain is in being part of the EU. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, Britain's not already not part of the Eurozone. It's never been part of the Eurozone. It doesn't have that currency and all the additional things that go with that.
The left response to the Brexit vote has been kind of really ineffectual and bizarre at times. And there's a disrespect for democracy and there's a disrespect for working people. On the one hand, it's really counterproductive. On the other hand, it's understandable because there's such a fear of a populist right.
Right. I mean, that's one kind of sentiment you could say is on the left in a certain way. I think it's more like people who woke up on Friday morning and were totally shocked and were just kind of desperately saying, no, no, you know, they were in denial.
Yeah.
You know, like, okay, you know, let's have a do-over, you know. Right. I mean, that's not going to happen. It's not going to go anywhere.
Right.
What I am much more concerned about is the left, the portion of the left in Britain, elsewhere in Europe, in the United States, which that portion of the left, which basically encouraged the exit of Britain. You know, it's not like I'm supporting the Remain or anything like that. I mean, that's not the point.
Yeah.
But my real problem is what we have here is, and it could have been anticipated, it should have been anticipated, what we have is a tremendous victory for UKIP, a racist, isolationist, nationalist party, and the British National Party, and the English Defense League. I mean, these are the big winners, and the National Front in France, you know, and Trump in the U.S., they're winning and they're basking in the glory as well by association. And there were sections of the left, so to speak, that enabled this. Why did this happen? And it happened because there are people... Something has happened such the left has become anti-neoliberalism much more than it's or a certain section of the left, anti-neoliberalism much more than anti-capitalism, and by far much more than like interested in the project of, you know, the social revolution and reconstruction of society in the beginnings. You know, and this has obviously happened. It's been happening over decades. I hope that this is a wake-up call to people that there are forms of capitalism that are, like, bad, that are not neoliberal, and there are things that are worse than the neoliberal establishment, to be making common cause with them. You know, even if you think you have it, you have an independent position and an independent set of reasons. You know, if the Brexit wins, your thinking is not going to be dominant in a case like this. The winners are going to be UKIP, you know, and the winners are going to be the BNP and the EDL. And there is going to be, an increase in racist attacks and in attacks on foreigners. And that's what's been happening in the last several days. Come on, people, be alive to the dangers. There's a real danger here. If the referendum had been seen in the context of, you know, the hard xenophobic nationalist right, the anti-immigrant, the racism, if it had been seen in that context, then people would not be saying, okay, yeah, well, we'll vote, we'll encourage people to vote leave for our own reasons, and, you know, we're cool because we're not mouthing the stuff that's coming from the far right. You're giving aid to them, even if you don't. Okay, even if you've got your own independent set of reasons. The problem was that this was looked at as, you know, on the left, a lot of the left, as, oh, you know, this is a vote on neoliberalism, right? And we're against neoliberalism. They didn't look at the bigger danger, I think, and this is still happening. Okay, I mean, I'm reading a lot of things by, you know, the so-called Union for Radical Political Economics. I mean, I use the term radical because they use it, but I mean, yeah. I looked at what was written, you know, a number of different things, and it's all about neoliberalism, all about neoliberalism. This is after the vote, you know, this is after the Brexit referendum. Their minds are still all on defeating neoliberalism, or you get this stuff where, well, neoliberalism is to blame for this. you know, look, I don't like neoliberalism either, but the problem is, why is this viewed as the enemy? There's something really, really wrong here. If you had like a left that was really, first of all, revolutionary, wanted a new society, that would be the standard by which you're judging things. These are statists, you know, and they don't like free trade. They don't like markets. They don't like finance. This is what's driving them, and the sentiments are driving them into basically the arms of UKIP. I mean, Michael Hudson, you know, he wrote this piece, and it was on that IRPE, Union for Radical Political Economics website. He says flat out, there's now a convergence of left and right.
Well, what does he mean? What's converging exactly there? Just to spell that out a little bit more.
I think it's very unclear because this was like a transcribed interview. It's not entirely clear, but I think he means that left and right opposition to neoliberalism is converging.
The term neoliberalism is a very curious one. First of all, it's not liberal by any means, as we've discussed, and it's not new. It was neoliberal policies, or something rather like them, that created the Third World. If you go back to, say, the 18th century, the centers of the world economy were China, India, mostly, and it changed. The differences between the rich and the poor were not very great, nowhere near like today. Europe grew and developed, first England, and the United States, Germany, Italy, and so on. They developed by radically violating what are now called neoliberal principles, strong states, direct intervention in the economy, and so on. India and later China were devastated, and the same is true of what we now call the Third World. How? By forced imposition of market principles. And this is furthermore well known. So if you read serious economic historians, Paul Baroche, for example, he simply points out protectionism and state intervention created the rich and developed societies. He doesn't call it neoliberalism, but forced liberalization pretty much created the Third World. To see how every element of the neoliberal package is specifically designed to undercut democracy. It's rarely discussed, and people talk about its economic effects. But just think it through. Let's take, say, financial liberalization core. For Keynes, the greatest achievement of the Bretton Woods system, post-war system, was to institute financial regulation. And there's a reason. That provides space for governments to undertake programs that are supported by the population. If you have no constraints on capital flow, then you can attack currencies frequently, freely. Now that creates what international economists sometimes call a virtual parliament of investors and lenders who can, I'm quoting from technical literature, it can carry out a moment-by-moment referendum on government policies. And if they think the policies are irrational, they can vote against them by capital flight or by attacks on the currencies and so on. The policies that are irrational are, by definition, those that benefit people but don't improve profit and market access and so on. And therefore, governments face what's called a dual constituency, their own population and the virtual parliament. And the virtual parliament usually wins, especially in poor countries.
In terms of influence, first of all, the vote was very close. If 2% of the vote had shifted, Brexit would have lost. Okay? If young voters had come out in bigger numbers, and I mean, about 3/4 of them favored Remain. If they had come out in bigger numbers, the Brexit would have lost. And, you know, Corbyn, who's still the leader of the Labour Party, he, why did the Parliamentary Labour Party just vote no confidence in him? Because they thought that he didn't present a strong and effective case in favor of remaining. Okay. And what is that all about? It's because he was, you know, he said we should remain, but we need to reform the EU. He didn't like, first of all, he you know, whether you like the EU or not, he didn't like come out as a staunch defender and say this is good for us, blah, blah, blah. Okay. But second of all, I mean, you know, my point is here, look at the, you know, xenophobic nativist forces, you know, that are being unleashed right now. And, you know, why was that not a feature of, you know, the discourse? Okay. I mean, Corbyn is a man of the left. You know, and okay, people had all kinds of positions, this and that. I think that there are a lot of people out there who think that neoliberalism, you know, or the elites, people who fancy themselves of the left, that these are the main enemy. So let's not like be all out to stop Trump. Let's not be all out to stop UKIP, and so forth and so on. I think it's really desperation, wherein leftists who really see no alternatives, no opportunities, try to latch on to right-wing kinds of populism as opportunities. The character of a lot of the left has changed. What they are really against is neoliberalism. Not because they're in favor of something else. There are people who are just against finance, you know, and they are against markets. And this is what drives them. And I think that this is a much bigger factor on the left than it was, you know, say 30 years ago, 20 years ago. To my mind, this is, you know, just like a terrible mistake, but it's... you know, I mean, and we've spoken about this before. I mean, why is it the case that you get the left continually running this line like neoliberalism is responsible for the economic crisis and it's a sea change in economic policy that is responsible for this? When I mean, the facts don't bear out those things. You know, and I think it's that people want to say, it's just like one section of pro-capitalist interests against the other ones. They're all blaming each other all the time. And I think that that's what's going on with a lot of the left. These are people who are against neoliberalism and they want to blame it for whatever happens. You know, they're blaming neoliberalism for the outcome of the Brexit vote. Right. I think that's kind of bizarre, but I mean, these are people. I know these kinds of people. I've been around them really my whole adult life, and I've just never understood what makes them tick, how they think. There's a really kind of deep rooted, visceral hatred of commerce, hatred of finance, hatred of markets. That has nothing liberatory or even progressive about it. I mean, this is what it's concerning me, because this is the thing that is keeping people from seeing the danger of the, you know, the nativist, xenophobic, racist right.
You're not just talking about the kind of people that go out and march around and have opinions, but you're talking about opinion makers.
I don't know if they're opinion makers, but yeah, I mean, I'm not talking about, you know, the sort of rank and file people. No, I'm not talking about them. No, not at all.
But the thing is, it's hard to distinguish between you know, rank and file opinion and these kind of thought leaders on the left, because often enough, you know, you talk to people who are at a protest and they've been reading this, the same small set of people. Like David Graeber is a big thought leader on the far left, especially I think amongst younger people. But the point is, it's hard to distinguish between rank and file opinion and the thoughts of these guys. So I'm not sure why I raise that, except just to say part of what we need to accomplish to fight off the right is to get people interested, rank and file people interested, and thinking for themselves and thinking as deeply as they can. And maybe the way to start is to by being very critical of these thought leaders.
Yeah, I mean, I think these folks can be challenged on the what you're calling the thought leaders on the left. I think they can be challenged when one is able to get a platform to challenge them. In the run-up to, I think it was April 19, 2000. That was the big Washington post-Seattle march. I managed to get onto a platform in New York City. It was in a church, big hall. It was packed. And you had like the head of 50 Years Is Enough, and you had all these people there. And I was talking, and I, you know, said something like, the problem is capitalism. We got to get rid of capitalism. And the, you know, the room just broke out into the spontaneous applause. Okay. And this was not the line of, you know, the 50 Years Is Enough and so forth. I was able to challenge some of what was being said. And I said, look, the WTO, the IMF, the World Bank, these are not the real problem, these institutions, you know, it goes to capitalism. The woman who was speaking for 50 Years Is Enough, later in the discussion, she said, yeah, these are symbols. It was an admission that there was probably another agenda there, but they were using these as symbols. And my response was, well, you know, that's all well and good. They're symbols. But the point of a symbol is you then talk about the thing that is being symbolized. And that's what they didn't do, you know. I've been trying to challenge the anti-neoliberal line on the causes of the economic crisis and everything like that. But on the left, these people have much more sway, and it bleeds into, you know, the discourse in the Democratic Party, Bernie Sanders, but even like mainstream Democrats, Clinton-style Democrats, they all pretty much say the same thing when you get down to it.
At the moment, though, the left's position has to be to hold back the right. I mean, criticizing the anti-neoliberal line at the moment means primarily criticizing their convergence with the right.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, you know, Michael Hudson said there's a convergence with the right. I don't know that I would go that far, you know, to make a literal statement. But I mean, we have to go all out against the people who are saying Trump is better than Clinton. Yeah, you know, right. Or, hey, we don't know, it's a roll of the dice, so things are terrible, so let's just roll the dice. Maybe the election of Trump will, you know, not mean the end to democracy and, you know, freedom of the press, and he might not build a wall, and he might not, you know, keep out all, he might not. I mean, We have to go all out against that kind of sentiment. I'm not going to vote for Hillary Clinton. I don't support Hillary Clinton in any way, shape, or form. I never have. I have loathed her. I you know, back in the 90s, every time she or her husband, who was president, got on TV, I was like nauseated by just the corruption and dishonesty of those people. Okay, at a time when they just ooze they just ooze corruption and dishonesty, okay? I have nothing nice to say about either of them, okay? But
right.
There's no question that the election of Donald Trump would lead us towards authoritarianism, and that could unleash, you know, even more reactionary trends as things went on.
So when you say you're not going to vote for Hillary Clinton, that's just a personal choice that you're making. And, you know, it probably won't be very consequential, but
it won't be consequential at all,
right?
Because I live in New York State.
Right.
Okay. You know,
right.
Hell's going to freeze over before Trump's going to win New York State.
But for someone like you, the important thing is you, not whether you vote for Hillary Clinton, but whether you're seen to be campaigning in any way for someone like Jill Stein, right? Or for the Green Party, or for some alternative to Hillary. Whether or not you're going to try to rally any part of the left that you have sway over towards the Greens at a time when Hillary needs every left of center vote that she can get to keep Trump out of office.
I don't think the most effective way of stopping Trump is by voting.
Okay.
Okay. But yeah, when on November 8th or whenever the damn election is, it's got to be, I think, really made clear that this would be a terrible disaster if he were to win. Whatever little you can do, you know, in the ballot box to stop that, yeah, you got to stop that. I don't think the election of a vote, well, you're not going to elect Jill Stein yet. I don't think a vote for Jill Stein would do that. A vote for Jill Stein is a protest against the status quo.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Fine. The problem is, how do you protest against worse than the status quo?
You go to the rally, you protest actually in person.
Yeah. Right. And I mean, Trump, I think, can be stopped on the ground. I think that the hardcore of his support, you know, are people who have an authoritarian personality. They think they feel weak, they feel powerless, they want a winner, they want a big daddy to protect them. And I just think that tactically, the people who are protesting and fighting with Trump supporters have got it completely wrong, because I understand the limitations that they're working against, but what happens? You know, they get kicked, they get spat at, the protesters, they get dragged away by the cops, they look like losers, Trump looks like the big winner, and that just reinforces the sentiment for him. If these people were able to claim the stage, you know, you would need big numbers to do this and not let Trump get away. I mean, I'm for a debate, right? I'm not for like stopping him from speaking, right. But if you could turn his rallies instead of promotional events into a real debate, you know, and force him to confront what you're saying, then I think this could be turned around. I think that would actually be much more effective than talking about voting for Hillary Clinton or Jill Stein or whatever.
Right.
You know, it's just like, you remember the end of The Wizard of Oz? This is just a little scared little man, you know, behind a curtain manipulating certain levers. Okay? That's what's got to be exposed.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you ever see a Face in the Crowd?
No, I haven't. What is it?
It's a movie with Andy Griffith.
Writers. Oh, if they ever heard the way that psycho really talks.
Choreography, Don Krantz. Scenic design, James Fitzsimmons. Costumes by Robert Hodes. Unit manager, George K. George.
Does it really sell that stiff as a man among men?
Are those morons out there?
Yeah. I can take chicken fertilizer instead of tuna for caviar. I can make them eat dog food and they'll think it's steak.
Sure, I got them like this.
You know what the public's like, a cage full of guinea pigs.
Good night, you stupid idiot. Good night, you miserable slob.
There are a lot of trained seals. I toss them a dead fish and they'll flap their flippers.
Well, Jim.
close a walk with thee.
So I have no belief that I can unite the left or anything around anything. Okay, all I can do is warn of things like the danger of Trump, the danger of UKIP, say to the anti-neoliberal people, or probably more realistically to the people who are listening to those people. Look at the situation that they've gotten you in. They've gotten you into a situation that has encouraged UKIP, National Front, you know, it's given encouragement to the Trump campaign and so forth.